Welcome to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we'll have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community of, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send in a question or a favorite recipe, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com or visit our website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Also, if you would like to hear prior shows, the most recent five, the last five, including this one, are archived on the website at recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows, including the last five, are archived at the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thanks. Now let's get started. You know, this time we're going to answer a question that I get a lot, and we often assume that the group is already formed when we talk, because we talk about how the group dynamics and how to deal with people and how to prevent arguments and like that. But I get a lot of questions about how do the groups form? Where do you get your participants from? How do you get your group? And, you know, it's a real good question, because they have to form someplace, and, oh, we're getting a lot of participation. Thank you already. And, you know, a lot of people are saying, Bobby and others are saying, that they form because people have common interests and opinions. That's a good point. And, yes, that would be that even if you have differences of opinions between the sides, they all have a common goal, and they all want to do something. It's just a question of how to do it. And, you know, Holland's making, and other people are making an interesting point. She says that you have to have people with strong enough opinions to do something about it, whatever it is. Yes, you have to have people with strong opinions. And that's why sometimes, well, we have to try to keep control of the situation, because strong opinions sometimes lead to, well, to strong opinions, yes. And, you know, and this is true to a lot of people. Mark and others are saying that they're members within a larger group with specific common interests. That is often true. Usually there is an issue involved that we are trying to resolve, that we are trying to make change, and it is people who have a specific interest who want to join. Well, people are calling it a subcommittee. I hate to call things a subcommittee, because I don't know that we have a bigger committee, but it is a subgroup of a larger group. And, for example, people are using the examples of churches and religious institutions and political gatherings, and they say that participants are moved to answer a call to action. Yes, Patrick and others, that's a good point. A call to action. Somebody, somewhere, a leader, has said we need to do this. We need, like Colin says, we need to do something about it, whatever it is. Yes, we need to do something about this. And they have put out a call to action. And people who have the time and the strong opinion and the interest will indeed form a group, will kind of come together to make a difference, to make change. Gary and others are using the term political action group. Now, I know this is a global show, so this isn't necessarily true everywhere, but in the United States, a political action group is usually formed by a political party. Now, this could be the type of group you're dealing with, but I think, yeah, I'm getting some dissension on that. I think we, for the purposes of talking about Recipe for Peace Now and of making consensus, we tend to think of political action more in the sense of there is something that we need to change that has to do with the government. A political action group would be something that is done for a candidate in the United States. But yes, Gary says that's what he meant, that it's something that needs to be changed and you need to talk to politicians about it. Yes, that's a political action group by me. You're absolutely right. And, you know, Maya and others are making a point that oftentimes people band together because they are members of a discriminated against group, and they band together to effect change. And we're getting a lot of agreement to that, and we're seeing race and religion, oh, and sexual orientation, and some sort of group who's being discriminated against. A law is not fair to them, or law needs to be implemented, for example. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm getting some dissension about what we're talking about, because people are saying that it doesn't have to be so much of a real personal opinion, that a lot of times groups are formed because of work-related issues in common. Yeah, that's a good point. It's not so much that you have such a personal zeal, but you have a work-related issue that other people have, and it needs to be resolved. Yes. And that, people using the word unions and ombudsman and like that. Yes, sometimes there are venues in which you work through work-related problems. Yes, a good point. And, you know, a lot of us do seminars and workshops about employee disputes, about getting along, about employee discrimination and how not to do such a thing. And like this, and those are all work-related issues, yes. And Cassidy and others are saying not only work-related issues, but economic issues. You might have an economic issue in common. Okay, people are saying tax laws. Yes, that's on the mind of a lot of Americans now because the tax laws are changing again. And, you know, and people are saying that's everywhere, and it absolutely is. But economic issues, the minimum wage law is being mentioned. Yes, good point, that in the United States, and I know this is a global show, but there's other economic issues. But in the United States, for example, the minimum wage is set by the government, and that sometimes people band together to make a change in it, or businesses band together to make a change in it. And there is quite a bit of discussion about the fact that economic and political issues come together if you have a rally. A good point. If you have a protest, for example, in other countries, in Greece and elsewhere, they've had economic protests. Very good point you've made, yes. And that is, of course, that's a very big group. And you'd have to have participation and mediation and negotiation and consensus with the leaders. But we're going to discuss that in a second. But, yes, those are all very, very good. Thank you for all of your participation. Thank you very much. And, you know, Julia says that you don't even have to have a dispute or an issue. And this is a good point. She says that a think tank group would be one that evaluates hypothetical outcomes. That you could have a group that is thinking on something. What a good point, yes. A think tank group. Say that 7 times fast. Yes, good point. And, you know, a point is being made, and it's really true. Betty and others are saying that we always talk about having groups that have a dispute, that have an issue, but sometimes, and want to change something, but sometimes the goal is to maintain the status quo. You don't always want to make change. Sometimes a different group is trying to change something that you like, that the group of people that you're dealing with likes, and they want to maintain the status quo. Interesting, yes. And, you know, Glenn and others are saying that you actually form over the internet in chat rooms. You know, this is a really good point because we've been talking about how the participants come together on a theoretical, on a similar ideas point, but people are telling me how they get together physically, the process on how the group is formed. And a lot of people say that you get together over the internet in chat rooms, Glenn says so, and that you develop into face-to-face, depending on geography, but mostly you debate online. And generally speaking, Recipe for Peace Now does face-to-face, don't we? Even if the face-to-face is video conferencing and Skype and like that. But, of course, sometimes people are very far flung geographically and that they need to debate, they need to talk online. And also the point is being made, very good point, that they need to communicate online in order to get together and in order to get a movement going. For example, people can come to an event. People can come to a protest, a rally, because they were informed of it and chatted about it and thought about it online. Very good point. And Joan and others are saying the Skype and video conferencing for FaceTime with online participants. Yes, it is true that a lot of times I do indeed do video conferencing. I don't prefer it because I think it's more one-on-one. You get further faster when you do it in person, but a lot of times that's unavoidable. People just can't all get to the same place at the same time. And yes, we don't usually promote a particular type of technology on this show, but yes, Skype is very common and very easy to use, or a Skype-like service. You know, Elizabeth and others are saying that blogging creates group participation, and you can become active to lobby for change using social media. Yes, and social media, of course, has great power, and we've seen that, and that is indeed how a group forms and a group participates. Good points. You know, generally speaking, on this show, we talk about more of a face-to-face type concept because we talk about making a convivial atmosphere and using food for the time out and for maintaining consensus and for pushing forward down the path. And we don't generally talk much about social networking and social media. We use it as an adjunct, really, don't we? Because that's how we connect with each other. That's how we send emails. We do Facebook. We connect. But the actual event is usually a smaller group and is more face-to-face. So I think the next question is there an advantage to face-to-face physically in the same room for participation? Are we doing it right? Or should we really emphasize more the social media side? Now, I know a lot of shows do. They emphasize the social media greatly. And we tend somewhat not to. But that doesn't mean it doesn't have a place. Pardon me, I took a sip of water. Excuse me. So, let's see what we've got. Thank you for all of your participation. Let's see. Berger says that face-to-face is better because you get more actually done because you've committed to the event. You've committed your time. You know, it's a good point. People do come prepared. They come with their research prepared. They come with their opinions prepared. And it's kind of an event, isn't it? Because we make a convivial atmosphere. Good use of a term, Berger. It's an event, and people have peer pressure, yes. And also, They want to get somewhere so that the next time they come, we've pushed forward. Or maybe we can even resolve something right now, right while we're sitting there. So, you know, if there's an advantage to face-to-face because you're physically in the same room because you have committed to the event. Good point. And a lot of people are saying that it's better to negotiate and reach compromise if you're actually looking at each other because you've got body language, you've got opinions, you've got vocal, you've got voice, tone, etc., and you can really tell what people are saying, and that a lot of times if you are doing it written, so to speak, by emails, by blogging, by Facebook, by Twitter. Well, Twitter's even, I mean, it's got, 140 characters. But if you're doing it like that, it doesn't convey the full meaning. And that consensus is better reached, compromise is better reached, if you don't have to write it. And write it kind of tersely, kind of sparingly, because the voice and the attitude and everything make a difference, and it will lead to compromise better. And, you know, Sarah says you have to think through your position because of peer pressure not to look like an idiot. Yeah. You have to think, if you're face-to-face, you have to think through your position because of peer pressure not to look like an idiot. Well, I don't know that anyone ever, we're never going to admit that anyone looks like an idiot, right? Right. But, you know, it is a point that you have to really think it through in order to face-to-face. There's a commitment to it. And, you know, Raymond also says that you can't be anonymous. There's no anonymous posting or fake names to hide behind. Yeah, no anonymous posting or fake names to hide behind if you're going to be sitting face-to-face. You know, this is a good point. Frederica and others are making it, pardon me, that when you go face-to-face, you naturally have a limited number of people. You have a smaller participant group and who are more committed to actually finding a solution. A smaller participant group who are actually more committed to finding a solution. Well, it's kind of a commitment to come in person, isn't it? And the way we do it, you might even have to bring a potluck item. And so, yeah, it is rather a commitment of time and effort, and you have to truly be strongly invested in order to do that. And it's definitely a smaller participant group. After all, with social media, we can have hundreds of people, more, thousands of people, but to sit in a room together, it's kind of, yeah, it's a smaller participant group, hopefully of the leaders, people who can actually do something once they make a decision, right? A lot of people are saying that the reason that you meet face-to-face is that Caroline says you have a greater chance of reaching consensus with a plan to go forward. A greater chance of reaching consensus with a plan to go forward. Now, we've talked about the yeses because you know that I think that it's valuable to meet face-to-face and to create a convivial atmosphere and to reach consensus like that. I think it's valuable to see the other people in person, if possible. But we've got a lot of people in the other camp. And thank you for all of your participation. We have a lot of people who are saying, no, that this is the modern world and that it's better to do it online, to do it through meetings online, to do it through video conferencing if you'd like, but that's about as far as we want to see each other. And, you know, Colin and others are making a very valid point about that there's strength in numbers and that you could affect change quickly, especially in the political arena. Strength in numbers and you can affect change quickly, especially in the political arena. You know, that's very valid, and there are, you know, I'm going, yes, I'm going to say the sentence that you the phrase that I use all the time, that everybody says you use that all the time. Well, it depends. There are some issues that are magnificent for online. They don't need a group meeting together in person in a convivial atmosphere because they can be resolved and affected online because they're not so ongoing to get change like that. And there are strength in numbers. If you need big numbers, you want to make a rally, you want to make a protest, hey, now we're getting somewhere. Online is good for that. You know, I don't know if they do it, if there's such a thing in other places, but there is the idea of flash mobs in the United States where people are online and they're told to appear at a certain time someplace and do something. Well, they're not particularly rallying for a cause. It's kind of fun. But it's the same concept. And, you know, it's a very good point. Mm-hmm. And Lupe says that online is useful to create an in-person response, like rallies and protests. Yeah. Online will get you to tell you where to come and to get you enthusiastic about the cause. And a lot of people are saying, Victor and others are saying that, thank you very much for your participation, that Victor and others are saying that online is faster and convenient to everyone. You don't have to negotiate a mutually agreeable meeting place or time. Very good point. It is sometimes hard to get everybody together, isn't it? And sometimes we have to meet in smaller groups and then get together with the bigger group and like that. And the timing, the time and place, are often kind of a pain. This is true. And you don't have that online. That's a good point. I think that, you know, I do it sometimes online. I do it, you know, I've had a lot of experience, and I've been doing mediation and alternative dispute resolution for nearly 30 years. And when I started, of course, there was no online. And I'm doing more and more of the procedurals online, of the getting out of the way, the little nagging details. And I find, personally, that people do like to appear in person. It's kind of a treat nowadays. And the people would like to meet the other leaders in person. They'd like to, well, it's an overused word. Yeah, people using the word network. Yeah, in the true, I'd like to deal with you again. Let's see what needs to be done so we can have an ongoing relationship type phrase, not in the kind of overused, just stick your card in my hand type idea. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people are saying that online allows activism on your own schedule so that you will truly respond and get others to respond too. Ari, that's a good point. That you can, that if you do it online, you don't have to appear anyplace. And you can look at it at your own leisure. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are talking about the speed of social media. And Jackie says that although it reaches out to the world with speed, the question is the staying power if you need more than the initial reaction. See, I'm going to say it depends again, aren't I? Because that's the thing. If you have participant group of leaders who can actually do something, who are committed individuals, they can meet in person and then they can reach out online to their followers. It's not an exclusionary idea. It's not one or the other. It's using both. But sometimes, due to the ease of meeting online, sometimes people forget about the meeting in person part, too. And the participants, A, like that. Most people like to meet in person. It's interesting. And also, for something that needs ongoing, well, it needs to meet in person and over the internet. Yes, use all of the tools and resources. You know, it's just a wonderful, the internet and the other tools are just tools, right? They're tools and resources, and I'm getting a lot of agreement with that. Use both. Yes, it's not an either or. It's not an exclusionary idea. And, you know, a lot of people, this is a very good point. And it's really a question of reaching the leadership, isn't it? Because you can reach a million people online with an issue, with a cause, with something. And you can do it fast, and you can do it effectively, and you might even be able to get them to do something, like rally in some way, or make phone calls, or send emails, or contribute in some way. But what you really need to get together in a group, in the room, together, so that the cause, whatever it is, the issue, can go forward, is you need the leadership, don't you? You need the people who can do something now that you've gotten everybody's attention. So how do we choose the leader? How does this person get chosen? And how does the leader then create a group that has power to effectuate the group decision? Because, you know, just talking is nice, but it doesn't get you anywhere. You got to have people who can do something about it, who are really willing to go out there and do it. And, you know, and people are saying that's where the internet and the actual getting together meld, because, of course, the leader connects with their followers oftentimes using social media. Very good point. And, you know, Maya says that that leaders have followers, which naturally creates the group. Sometimes, yes. I'm going to say it depends again, because it does. It kind of depends how you're defining group. I think we're kind of defining it as the people who come and participate in person, because that's what we're interested in seeing, in dealing with. And if that's true, then it depends on the numbers. Mm-hmm. Leaders, followers naturally create the group. Yeah, it's a big group, but you need the subgroup to come. And Brooke says it's usually the most outspoken and the most eloquent is designated as the leader. Other people are saying the strongest, the most opinionated, the strongest, the one who's the most definite. I think perhaps a combination of both. And Eleanor and others are pointing out, thank you for all your participation, that a leader often has expert skills, and then will bring them to other, and then the leader not only has expert skills, but the leader will bring other experts on board to create the group. So the leader might choose the group. I think that's often in practicality what happens. Now, the leader doesn't choose every group, of course. Each group has a leader, and you might have different sides coming together to reach consensus, to negotiate. But the leader often chooses who's in the group because he knows people's expertise. He knows who is good at it. And also I'm seeing he knows who he can trust. And yes, it's a very good point is being made that oftentimes the leader will choose people who agree with him or her, which is not always the strongest group. But that is human nature and very realistic, yes. And it's something you have to think about and something you have to acknowledge. And let's see. A lot of people are calling the smaller participatory group, Noel and others, an executive committee. You see, it's not just the followers that decide, but you need a manageable size and like-minded people. And people are saying that that's like an executive committee, a committee of decision makers. Very good analogy. Thank you, Noel and Eleanor and others. It's a a subgroup that has the power to sway and tell the followers what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it when we reach consensus, right? Mm-hmm. And Theo says that you need to speak one-on-one while participating with other groups with a differing agenda, and the leader is usually the spokesperson. The leader is the spokesperson for his or her group, right? When you're dealing with other types of people. Yeah. I kind of like the executive committee thought. I never thought of it like that. Thank you very much. I always learn something in these shows, and I hope you do too. I kind of like the executive committee thought because we all understand we're not using it in a corporate way, right? Yes. Because you come in person, either physically or through video conferencing, and you come to our group of a group of reasonable size for Recipe for Peace Now purposes, and you need to be focused. People are talking about focus and consensus, and you need to be able... All right, I'm getting a lot of people using the word enforce, and I suppose it is an enforcement. You need to be able to, well, I guess I will use the word enforce. You need to be able to enforce the decision of the small group, right? And that's kind of the key to it. That's why we try to get them to reach consensus, because they lead the others. And they have their followers, and they lead them. And so if the leaders reach consensus, the followers will too. And whatever it is that needs to be done, we'll get done. We'll work towards it. It'll be good. We'll work together. And that's really why we make the convivial atmosphere, because you need to compromise, you know, and you need to be able to negotiate. You need to reach consensus. You know, Jordan and others are making a last point, and then, yes, people are asking, are we using the recipes? Yes, we are. That you create the ability for follow-through and regularly scheduled get-togethers if it's an ongoing situation that needs to be monitored for progress. Good point. That you really do it in person and with the leadership. And also, you know, every meeting's not in person, right? It's an occasional get-together when you've really got something big to decide. But the little stuff, you do that online nowadays, yes. You don't need to make a whole meeting over some sort of procedural thing or something. But it creates a bond between the various groups, the various sides, the various leaders, so that you can regularly meet and decide and make sure the progress is being made. Make sure that you're really going forward, that you're really accomplishing whatever it is, right? And that's the main thing, to try to have a forum so that we can reach consensus. And that's the whole idea of the thing, right? A forum for consensus is really, really what we do, isn't it? That's what we need. And, yes, if you're going to meet in person and you're going to have a forum and you're going to have consensus, I think you could have a convivial atmosphere. Yes, yes. And Recipe for Peace Now usually talks about how can you do this. It's because we use food as a tool, not because we are feeding people, not because we are hungry necessarily, but because in any get-together of human beings, there comes a time when you need a timeout because people need to compromise a smidge. And, of course, the knee-jerk reaction, the initial reaction is, no, I don't want to compromise. But you need to keep them in the room, and they need to be able to think for a minute and think, well, if the other side came towards me just a smidge, I would come towards them just a smidge. And the way to do that in the convivial atmosphere is to serve some food, to have a potluck if you can, or, you know, it doesn't have to be homemade, really, but have a convivial atmosphere, and food helps that. Food and something to drink and like that. It just makes people more relaxed. They find something in common with each other, and already you've got some bonding going on, right? Now, I'm going to say what I say every single show, and I think it's so important that I keep saying it, and thank you for those of you who are returning. Yes, I know you've heard it, and thank you for the new people. And what, did I mention that everything's the last five are archived on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. Everything's archived on the radio station, blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. But you'll find that every show, I say the same thing. When you're going to have food at your workshop, seminar, mediation, community gathering, whatever it is you're doing, you need to email or however you're communicating ahead of time and ask people if they have an allergy, if they have a dietary restriction, or a religious dietary restriction. Mm-hmm. You need to ask them. And you need to tell everyone. And you need to tell everyone that whatever it is they're bringing needs to be labeled. Not just what it is, but what's in it. Because then people can judge whether or not they can eat it. You don't want someone to get sick or panicky or in any way have a bad time. This is a convivial good time. It's why people come back. Everyone likes a party. It's why people come back. So you need to have everyone label what is in it and be cognizant of food restrictions and allergies. Very important. So you all know that I also think that as the host, whoever is the host should have what I always call a safe recipe and kind of extra food just in case someone comes empty-handed or for some reason you have more people than you expected. And a safe recipe, in my opinion, is a recipe that has common, easily recognized in your culture, in your neck of the woods, in your area. Because I know that we are global, and everyone says I use a lot of chicken. It's because chicken is cheap out here and easy to come by. But, of course, you make substitutes, whatever it is you guys like. And it is easily recognizable, not too many ingredients, and generally speaking, not something that a whole bunch of people are allergic to. So, or have dietary or religious restrictions. So, this time our safe recipe is actually going to be a cold pasta salad. It's coming towards summer over here in the United States, and we think about kind of colder recipes at that time. Also, it's capable of being made ahead of time, which is kind of nice because we're all so busy. So, it's going to be a cold pasta salad with tomatoes and cheese and spinach. And also, you can see all the ingredients, but that's not going to keep us from labeling them, right? We need to label them anyway. But you can kind of eyeball it and go, oh, that's got tomatoes. So it actually is going to have like baked tomatoes. It's actually quite delicious. So we're going to use 12, usually small tomatoes. If you have them accessible, I like the little plum ones because they're very firm. They have a nice size, you can cut them real well, and they have a lot of firm skin on the outside. I'm going to sprinkle it with a little bit of sugar, just kind of like a tablespoon of sugar, maybe less than that. I tend to use sugar in addition to salt and everything. You don't have to if you don't want to. 6 garlic cloves chopped. I know some of you think I use a lot of garlic. Some sort of pasta that is not long and thin, like a rigatoni, something tube-like, because we're going to mix this all together. And you could use a long, thin pasta, but it will look better and serve better if you don't. So 2 pounds of, I'm going to say like a rigatoni pasta, that we're going to cook al dente, drain, and we're going to cool it because we don't want to melt the cheese is what it really is. We're going to set them aside and let it cool. 1/2 cup of lemon juice, a half cup of olive oil, a pound of a firm type cheese that's very thinly sliced, like a Parmesan, something white and kind of firm, and 4 cups of baby spinach, the leaves. In the United States, you can buy them in a bag. That's actually a bag pre-washed. It's fantastic. But 4 cups of baby spinach, if you need to, and you're really using really fresh baby spinach, I mean, I like to use, well, all right, we call it fresh, but it doesn't come in a bunch. It really comes in a bag. Remember that spinach sometimes has some grit to it, some sand or whatever, so you need to wash it off really, really well if you've got a bunch that comes from a farmer's market or something. Yes. Okay. So we're going to do this to the tomatoes first. Well, actually, first we did the pasta, right? And then we drained it and set aside to cool. We're going to preheat the oven to about 350. We're going to cut the tomatoes in half if they're the plum tomatoes, in quarters if they are small, regular, round-type tomatoes. And we're going to put them on a baking tray. I personally like to line the tray with a little bit of foil so that you don't get the sticking, but a non-stick tray would do it if you prefer. And we're going to sprinkle the tomatoes with the sugar and some salt and pepper and the garlic, because we're going to bake the garlic too. Remember our chopped garlic? We're going to put all of this on the tomatoes. In fact, you can add some extra tomatoes if you like. Mm-hmm. And we're going to bake it for an hour. Because what we're trying to do is we're trying to dehydrate them and shrink them down and make them very, very tasty. And so we take them out of the oven and we're going to let them cool, just like we let the pasta cool. We're going to set them aside and let the whole thing cool, which is why this is a good recipe to put in the refrigerator for overnight and like that. If you do, and oftentimes I do, I think you should leave the cheese out until the last minute because the cheese gets a little bit funny. It doesn't get, it won't poison anybody or anything, but it doesn't look as nice. So you can do the whole thing. You can also combine this with a group. You bring the tomatoes, you bring the pasta, you bring you can combine it. It's a nice group activity. Those of you who have listened to the show before know that I think that actually cooking together, if you have the facilities, is a wonderful thing. This doesn't even need cooking facilities. You just combine it together. So we've got the tomatoes that have been dehydrated and seasoned and everything, right? They're cooling. The tomatoes have cooled. The pasta has cooled. So now we're going to combine the lemon juice and the oil. And we're going to take the tomatoes and all the accompanying goodies, the seasoning, the garlic, and we're going to combine that with the lemon juice and the oil. And then we're going to add it to the pasta and toss it all around, get it all in there. And then we're going to add the spinach because it doesn't get cooked really. It's raw spinach. That's why we used baby spinach, and the cheese. Yummy. Yes. You see, it's very easy to do. It's prepped easy. It's delicious. It looks beautiful. And it has very few ingredients that you can't actually see. I suppose that it's got the lemon oil in it, but you're going to label it, say what's in it, and delicious. Wonderful. All done. Maybe put a little bit of pepper on it. People are asking me about goat cheese. Yes, use whatever kind of cheese you've got. I think it looks better with a light-colored cheese that is not too really pungent in itself, although people are telling me that they make this kind of a thing with blue cheese, which is indeed, of course, very pungent. But the idea is to put the cheese and the spinach in at the last minute, after everything's been put together, and have everything be not hot so that the cheese doesn't melt and the spinach doesn't wilt. It's beautiful. It's delicious. Everybody likes it. And it's a safe recipe because there's not too much to be allergic to. It's actually even vegetarian. Huh, there we go. So, now we're going to have our adventure recipe. It's a little more complicated. You can indeed make it the night before, but it's got a lot more ingredients, and some of the ingredients might not be something that people can eat, or maybe they've never tried it. It's hard to know. So it's going to be, it's very fragrant and very delicious. It's a cinnamon clove lamb stew. A friend of mine came up with this, and I was like, yes, give me that recipe. It's just fantastic. Okay, here we go. We're going to have 4 small onions that we're going to chop, 2 tablespoons of oil, 2 tablespoons of grated ginger, fresh grated ginger root that we're going to grate, 2 cloves of garlic crushed, 3 cinnamon sticks. Yes, you can use ground cinnamon if you would like. Not cinnamon sugar, though. If you're going to use ground cinnamon, a couple of tablespoons of ground cinnamon. Not too many. People are saying that's not the equivalent of 3 cinnamon sticks. I usually use the sticks just because it looks nice, and then I fish them out afterwards. But you could certainly use cinnamon, ground cinnamon. Black peppercorns will also be good in this. You know you have to fish them out, right? 6 black peppercorns, 5 cloves, same idea. They taste wonderful. They give wonderful body to the dish. You got to fish them out. You can't just leave cloves and peppercorns in there in case someone bites into it. 2 pounds of some sort of lamb that's cubed. I like to use lamb with this, like leg of lamb or lamb tenderloin, whatever it is that looks nice, those lamb steaks type things, because we're going to cube it, so it doesn't have to be a certain amount. I like to take out pretty much all the fat. I'm not big on the fat that rises to the top on this. I skim it off. 4 cups of beef stock. You can use water if you like. And 2 tablespoons of cilantro that we're going to add at the very end just because it looks so nice. There we go. So, we're going to heat the oil in a big, large pan, and we're going to add the onion, and we're going to fry it until it gets all translucent and it smells really good. And then we're going to add half the ginger and half the garlic and stir them around and for about 5 minutes or so until they also cook through and would smell really, really nice. And then we're going to drop in the cinnamon and the peppercorns and the cloves, and the salts. This is where you can use, a lot of times I use ground cinnamon. Cinnamon sticks are delicious, but kind of expensive. At least they are here. And then we're going to add the lamb. We've got this whole little fragrant background going to it. And we're going to add the lamb to the pot, and we're going to fry it over medium heat. You got to keep stirring the darn thing. And we're going to scrape up the bottom of the pan to prevent the meat from sticking. And we're going to cook it for about what? About, I don't know, 5-10 minutes. About 6 minutes, I suppose. Now we're going to stir in the either water or the beef stock. I like beef stock. And you're going to cover it with a lid, and we're going to cook it over medium heat for about 45 minutes, or until the water is evaporated and the meat is nice and soft. I like to give it a stir occasionally. I know you have to take the lid off, but then at the very end you don't get the nasty surprise of it having stuck to the bottom of the pot. Now we've got stew, right? We've evaporated the water. The meat is very, very tender. Everything smells fantastic. And remember, we only put in half the ginger and garlic. We're going to add the other half now. And we're going to add the cilantro because it looks nice. Cilantro has a lovely taste and everything, but it actually looks very nice, just generally speaking. And we're going to stir it real thoroughly until it's all kind of incorporated, right? And to tell you the honest truth, we're done. We've cooked it. We've given it a little fry on the outside, the meat, so that it was browned. We've cooked it very thoroughly with a lidded pot. We've added at the last minute some garlic and some shredded ginger because it gives it some zest. And we fish out the peppercorns, the cloves, and the stick of ginger. The peppercorns, the cloves, and the stick of cinnamon, because you don't want anybody biting into it. So that's the ticket. You got to fish it out. You know what? People are telling me this. This is a very good point, and I don't know why I'm too dumb to know this, but if you're going to do, well, but you add them in. All right. A lot of people are saying that instead of having to fish for the cloves and the peppercorns, which are kind of small, that they would put it in a cheesecloth bag in with the broth when the whole thing is being cooked. You know, it's a real good point. And then you wouldn't have to fish them out. And then they'd be in there for the 45 minutes of the simmering and the cooking, and you'd get a lot of flavor out of them. And I don't know why I never thought of doing such a thing. I just fish it out with a slotted spoon. What do I know? But it's a very good point, because you can search for the little round balls for a while there. And that's an excellent idea. I'm going, next time I give out this recipe, I'm going to say, put the cloves and the peppercorns in a little bag. Very good point, because you can find the cinnamon stick. It's biggish, but those are kind of smallish. Thank you. That is an excellent tip. Thank you very much for mentioning that. Yes, because they have to be fished out. But anyway, there we have it. And, of course, you're going to make a big, nice bowl of either rice or pasta or couscous or whatever you like to serve underneath a stew. And you're going to have that to the side so people can take as much as they want. And you've got this lovely, very fragrant lamb stew. And yes, as usual, whatever it is that you'd like to substitute for the lamb, go for it. Just remember that it needs to be browned in the fry oil with the various herbs before you put the stock or the water or whatever it is you're doing. People are saying they could put half wine in. Yes, I don't usually use wine because a lot of people object to it in a recipe. But before you put the liquid in, you need to brown and basically cook it, and you need to adjust your time to cook whatever kind of protein you're using. People are asking about rabbit and pork and chicken and like that. Yes, you could substitute lamb for sure, but the answer is to make sure that it's all nicely incorporated and cooked through. Yes, yes. And that's true of all these recipes. You can substitute whatever it is you like, but it needs to be accommodated for the heat and for the cooking through. So that is our adventure recipe. It's our adventure recipe because it has a lot of levels of flavor. It has some items that you can't really see with your eye, like the ginger and the cloves and like that, because we've pulled them out. No, the cloves and the peppercorns, and you might have somebody who cannot eat that, which is why we need to label it. And it is more; it has more ingredients, and some of them are more unusual, at least in this area. So that's the adventure recipe. And now we have reached the end of our time together. Thank you very much for all of your participation. Thank you very much for coming. Please do come again. If you would like to contact us, we're at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. The website is recipeforpeacenow.com. If you would like to hear the last five, well, this will be one of them now, and four preceding this, it is archived on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com, and the rest of them, including those five, are archived at the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thank you very much for coming, and please do come again. Thanks. Bye-bye.